Ladies and gentlemen and food fans, we're about to launch into today's interview, and it's a really good one with a friend and colleague named Kevin Brosh. You know him from Iron Chef America. And if you're Canadian or a fan of Canadian media, you certainly know him from various projects, radio and children's television products that he's made for years and years and years. And, of course, we all know him as the Thirsty Travelers. Fantastic show. He's been to more countries than I even knew there were. Fascinating guy. We're going to have a long, long conversation. But here's the thing. I had a small technical issue during the session, and there is, as a result, the pristine audio quality that you've come to expect from this podcast will be oddly missing. The sound is going to suck, and it's got to do with the fact that I didn't do some things right, and I got in a hurry. And, well, that's just the way it is. But you can still understand everything we're saying. And it makes you feel like you're right there in the room with us. It just doesn't sound like it usually does. But you're still going to enjoy it. I know I certainly did. It's a little on the long side, but you know what? It's worth every minute. So we'll get to that now. Our interview, or our conversation, rather, with Mr. Kevin Brosh. So Alton Brown, this is the Alton Browncast. I'm recording again from my palatial dressing suite at on the sixth floor of Food Network, where Kevin Brosh and I have just finished a battle.
Let's get this party started.
Let's get this party started. So Kevin has brought in some alcohol, which is what I rely on him for. What do we have, a little Cote d'Aron action here?
A little Cote d'Aron, nothing over the top. 2009, about
how was 2009?
$16 a bottle. It was $16 a bottle.
Which tells us something.
Well, I think it's just, this is wine among friends.
Cheers. We're drinking out of compostable Ecotainer cups.
I'm coffee not really cups. Sure. Coffee cups, right? This is how we roll. If we're not drinking out of the plastic
quart, the pint or
the quart ones that the kitchen uses. Cheers, sir.
Mm. To you.
For those of you who don't know, I am the world's greatest wingman. I am Goose to my man Maverick.
Wait a second. No, Goose died, though.
That's okay. I've had a good run. That's how I explain myself to you.
Goose is not dead.
No, not to you. I'm for the very first time in the 12 seasons that we've been working together, I've never actually explained myself to you. This is how I explain myself to people around the world when they go, "What is he really like? What's it like working with him?"
It's like, I'm actually asked from time to time what it's like working with you. Because well, you've got a following. You've got the following.
Okay, let's get to the following. So this is the thing. When I was invited on this podcast, and I didn't think it was going to happen, I'm going to go to.
Why would it not happen?
You know, I see, when you work here at the Food Network, and when you work on Iron Chef America, you really know your place on the totem pole.
Well, where are you on the totem
pole? I'm very low on the totem pole.
You're low on the totem
pole. Every once in a while, you'll be in your hotel room following your advice of just go home and lock the door. So it's 10 o'clock.
I have told you that.
I'm watching SportsCenter, and I get a phone call from one of the former bosses, Bruce Siddall, right, who's not with the network anymore. And he'd go, "Why aren't you at dinner?" I'm going, "Oh, somebody never showed up." So I'm like the seat filler. And I'll go, "I'll be there really quick." Because you don't always play that
game. And did you usually show up?
I would show up, and I would get there for dessert, or I'd get there as they were leaving the restaurant.
So I would never show up.
I was your seat filler. See?
Thank you.
Goose, once again.
Goose.
So Twitter.
Are we going to Twitter?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to Twitter.
Hold on. Number of followers.
Kevin Brosh and I both have our iPhones out.
One of the greatest single days of my summer so far was when the gentleman that I'm speaking to right now followed me on Twitter.
I didn't know for a long time that you were even on there.
It's
that
drinking
I started
robot.
Following you.
It's the best Twitter
drinking
handle.
Drinking robot.
Given
is
to me.
Awesome.
Given to me in Taiwan.
You know what? Because I figured you would be. No, tell that. How did that happen?
I was over there launching season 5 of Thirsty Traveler, and it was 12 days after the tsunami. When the tsunami hit, and they were talking about canceling the trip, and I'd never been to Taiwan. And I said, "I really want to go to Taiwan. Is there anything we can do?" So we partnered up with Red Cross Hurricane Relief Fund. And
how hard was that to pull off in that amount of time?
I didn't have to do very much except get on the plane and go and just show up for the auctions and say very specific things that weren't the Asian sensitivities are sometimes different than North American ones. So as long
your
as you
little
were,
bitty differences in words count.
Yeah, exactly. And just being generous, and the tsunami didn't affect Taiwan at all. So it wasn't, but that's the base that we were working in, and we were raising money for countries and, you know,
That had been him.
Beside and, right. and alongside in Brothers in Arms. So we were over there and I was working with an American, Taiwanese-born American-educated DJ who was my wingman that night. And we were on two double-decker buses and we were going to five different places in Taipei on a pub crawl. And on the buses was an
opportunity. Are there good drinking places in Taipei?
There are very good drinking places in Taipei. That's what was so enlightening and so wonderful about going there. I can't believe I like Taipei as a city so much because they have the high-end things that you – you know, that's where Michael Jordan opened up his one of his first restaurants in Asia, in the Taipei 101. You know that
that's
101
the tower.
Yeah, the basement was Michael Jordan's bling – House of Bling in basketball.
House of Bling.
It was like, it was amazing nightclub. So we would get on the bus and people would ask questions. And after the answer, there'd
now,
be
who
some,
are these people? Who are most
they,
of these
they
people?
They were winners. They watched Discovery Channel and okay. they were fans of the Thirsty Traveler. They had won their way on the buses and they had made a donation to Red Cross Hurricane Relief.
So they had to be kind of super fans.
They were super fans. Yeah. And I'd tell the story. There would be a quick translation into Taiwanese and then there would always be a round of applause. Class. And on certain questions, they would go drinking robots. And one of the last questions of the evening, I told the best story and everybody was chanting, drinking robot. And I said to my wingman or the DJ, I said, what is drinking robot? And he said, dude, that's you. And I was like, don't F with me because that is the coolest nickname ever.
Where did they come up with it?
I have no idea. I can't trace the lineage back, but everybody on the bus referred to me as Drinking Robot because of the amount of drinking that would go on during Thirsty Traveler, and that was my nickname. And I was like...
Because that's like the most awesome handle of all time, but you want an explanation. You know, why Drinking Robot?
Well, because I drank like a robot.
Robots... I thought that maybe that's how they translated Thirsty Traveler or something. I mean, because that would have been a much... Because now what you need is a show called Drinking Robot. I mean, to heck with Thirsty Traveler.
The network, say, just maybe with your help. Could we produce it down in Atlanta
with
you?
I think that we could absolutely make Drinking Robot. People would watch that.
I'd even let you be Drinking Robot, and I could be... What would be the wingman?
No.
What would be the goose to the maverick of Drinking Robot?
When it comes to drinking, I would be your wingman. You're far more experienced.
I'd be that little wind-up duck. That you get, you know, those old school wind up super toys. Okay, so back to Twitter. So that's how I picked before I knew what Twitter was going to become. And, you know, you can still find me under Kevin Brosh or Drinking Robot. No, it's all one.
Just all one now. Okay. So what are we doing on Twitter?
We're looking at how many followers we have. This is the only time I was allowed to talk back. I said to Mr. Brown, see, I still call him Mr. Brown. I said, I'm going to bite you at the ankles and maybe up to about your shins, but I'm going to go no further because I'm not allowed to.
Well, so, yeah, you do bite anywhere you want.
Okay.
So what are we asking here?
Kevin Brosh at Drinking Robot, number of followers, looks like I've gone down by two this morning, 5,323.
You've gone down by two? Are you actually checking your analytics?
No, but apparently you can.
Yes, you can. But you can look at
my
your
numbers
direct.
Always seem a bit two or three higher on my computer versus my...
That's not uncommon.
Okay.
Because
so
it gets better.
I'm going to round it up to 5,330.
You should round it up. You asked me now how many I have?
And the other day he said, I don't know how many I have. I was like, you liar, because you just tweeted that you have 600,000 plus. So,
yeah, but the number changed almost immediately because I lost a bunch. You have to understand.
Why do you
lose
a bunch?
I lose some. There are days when I will lose 1,000 followers in a day.
So what do you do to lose 1,000 followers?
A lot of Post-its.
Is it too many for people?
It's too many. I start posting, and sometimes I get on a jag.
You're doing something that no one else on Twitter does. That's from that mind of yours.
I got the Post-it thing, but the thing is, you can really alienate a lot of people. So I lose on a day that I gain 1,200 people, I'll lose 800.
What's your number right now? As it stands? You can round up.
Okay, I'm not going to round up
to the nearest 10.
I'm not. It's 606,400.
600 and so in the last week I've gained 100 and you've gained 6,000. Talk about where you are on the totem pole.
No, but look, I have Food Network Star, my podcast of which you are now part of is going on, and Post-its. I got a lot of Post-its. Maybe
how long have you been on television? Now I'm about to hit 20 years. Next April I'm 20 years on television.
But you started in children's
TV.
And before that it was radio.
Yes, I was Reverend Kevin.
You got one of those Gemini Award things. Those are a big deal. That's like the high...
It's the Canadian Emmy. It's the Canadian Emmy. Yes, I did. We went and I beat Mike Holmes. You know Mike Holmes?
Yes.
I beat him that year. And he came up to my table, and that was when he was just starting to break. And it's a really hard thing because it's industry voted on,
right?
And the larger networks seem to often control the way the awards play out, the different unions and such.
Ah.
So if you work for a bigger network, and we were small, and we were a small little startup show, but Michael Holmes came up to me, the contractor guy, and he said, "I guess if I had to lose to anybody, you'd be the first person I'd lose to." And it was sort of a backhanded compliment.
That's kind of like saying, I'm better than you, but if I have to not be better than you for one night.
That's how I heard it.
And then you took home your award.
Yeah.
Hey.
But yeah, so 20 years. So how long have you been on TV?
I've been on TV since 1999.
Okay. So I got a few on you, and those were, I just, you know, lived in children's television.
Why children's television?
It was the first place that wanted me after radio.
Did you like it?
I loved it. It was live every day after school, Monday through Friday, 3:30 until 7 p.m. It was for, in Ontario, it was a government-run, so it had an educational curriculum that we had to follow, similar to like PBS. We were filling in commercial time. But we were doing 48 minutes. We were doing anywhere from 14 to 20 minutes live an hour for 3.5 hours. So we were getting almost an hour of live television time every day, 5 days a week.
And who was developing the material?
We were developing it all ourselves. We were doing our own makeup. The unions, because it was a nouveau kind of way of looking at things, we were in a lockbox. So it was like throwing to music videos, but with a bit more content.
Right.
So I had Kev the Poet, and I had the great Covino. You know, magician. We were taking very basic elements, talking to tweens and under. And it was, for me, it was a cross between Second City, SCTV, and Saturday Night Live. And it really made you think on your feet, which is how I started developing and learning for Thirsty Traveler. Right. And then what I was brought in to do here is just like
everything's
provide you information or you'll kill me.
No, not me.
And Ted Allen will be replacing me next season.
No, Ted Allen will be replacing me. But I'm curious why one would ever leave. Why'd you leave? Why not stay in children's television, which is incredibly lucrative?
I was producing my own show. And again, because we were working for a non-commercial, we were working for a government broadcaster, the budgets just got smaller and tighter and tighter. And at that point, I was thinking about stretching my wings and doing something else. And I said, you know, we can't do it for 10% less. It became a financial equation. It became the producer side of me, you know, and I was starting to bald and I was starting to gray and
not looking like a kid anymore.
I was just looking like a 29-year-old that was wearing shorts and a backwards ball cap, and it didn't feel right to me. And I wanted to try other things.
What was the genesis of Thirsty Traveler? When did that come along?
The Banff Television Festival, which happens in June in Banff, Alberta, Canada. It was won as an elevator pitch. It was the first year of Food Network Canada, which is the sister network.
Right.
And they were committed to doing something homegrown.
Right.
And so it was the very first show that Food Network Canada self-produced. And, you know, the Americans still had to sign off on it and whatnot. But it was one as a pitch, and it was called The Epicurean Traveler.
Okay.
Which, you know how big that show would have been.
So how did it go from Epicurean Traveler
I don't know. The short math is they really liked me. They liked my knowledge base. Putting myself through television school, getting a degree by working in bars and restaurants, I had some of that knowledge base, and the network felt that the show wasn't going to be a success if it didn't take some more chances and find something else out. So they rolled the dice a bit, and they said, can we, while you're out there putting the show together and shooting the pilot in Scotland, doing the whiskey trail, you know, make sure you get the shots of the salmon and, you know, the mashed potatoes and all of the other things, but maybe really focus on the whiskey a bit. And we brought back great stuff of both sides of the table or the equation. But
were you always interested in this?
My parents are German, so I grew up drinking beer and Liebfrau Milch, the German wine, the Black Tower.
Sure.
Yeah.
I like Liebfrau Milch.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell you the truth. No, I do. I I like German wine.
I just made him say, I love Liebfrau Milch.
Yeah, I do like Liebfrau Milch. I actually do. The headache is bad.
The headache is bad.
But I mean, at what point did you decide I would like to maybe make a show that is culinary and...
To be honest, I was found. Because I taken another job for the Canadian national broadcaster that was teen-based. Mm-hmm. And it was to be a convergence project where you couldn't watch the show without also going to the web. And you couldn't understand what was going on the web without watching the show.
Right.
And I was really into this charge, and the public broadcaster, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, really felt like I had achieved something, and the budgets were huge, and I've got to pour out and run some more wine as I hit
so you had jumped ship. You'd gone over to the other broadcasting.
Yes. And while I was there, I was offered this job by Bruce Sedell.
Can we swear?
Yeah,
sure.
Can I be?
Yeah.
So he comes up to Toronto.
Bruce Sedell, by the way, was the executive at Food Network who originally brought Iron Chef America in from Fuji TV, where it was originally produced. But then Bruce Sedell hasn't been with the network for a couple of years. He moved on to do other things.
Yeah.
But he ran the show. He's the showrunner from the network. So.
He massaged the relationship with Fuji to get to give the trust back that America could produce a quality food television show like the original.
He spent a lot of time with the Japanese.
Yeah.
Doing that. So anyway, so he calls you up.
So he calls me up. Emerald's in Toronto doing 6 episodes from Toronto.
This is when Emerald was at the top of Emerald.
And the Canadian network is just getting going. So Emerald came up and went to Chinatown in Toronto and went to Kensington Market and went to all our great markets. And he said, we have this show and I want you to do the show. And we met at the Rubino Brothers, a couple of Canadian chefs. They've competed.
Sure, they've been on this.
On Iron Chef America. And I was sitting there across the table, and I was like, I don't think I can do it. I think I want to stay with. And I remember Bruce Sedell looking at me and goes, do the show, Kevin.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, I'll do the show, because I really felt threatened by it.
Yeah, which is kind of...
which is kind of... I
knew Bruce, that wouldn't...
It's impossible. So I got back and I got the points on the paper that I needed to do the show.
Yeah.
And then I meet Bruce about a year and a half later. And Bruce is just not the guy that I had made him into that one night.
Right.
So I somewhere in the back of this junk on the top of my neck, I made it work, right? I wanted to make it work.
Made it work.
And, you know, so without Bruce and the trust in the network, it was a lottery win. It was a happy accident.
Win.
Yeah. But I realized, and I brought you some Cote d'Aron. I brought you one of these.
Thank you.
Fell off the back of a truck. No, I just had to bring you something.
These are spoons.
It's a chef's
and they're
spoon.
Styluses.
With the styluses, which I figured you might geek on.
I actually think that's awesome.
This is made by a friend of mine in Toronto.
It's a wooden spoon.
Yeah, he developed
it's about
them.
6 inches long with a pad stylus on one end.
And so you can pull it out of your chef's coat.
Yeah.
And you can actually go, if you're following a recipe...
You can
taste with it on the one end, and you can, you know, check your Twitter numbers on the other.
I'm not checking my Twitter numbers. Besides, I would have to have a pen, a Sharpie for posting this. This is pretty cool. It's a full-on stylus, and it's light because it's wood. Thank you. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Company's Umbra, a buddy of mine makes them. And, you know, so if I'm ever going to develop my own stuff like bar gear, I'm going to probably go to these guys. Did it work?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It works well.
So look at that. I figured he would just throw it in the pile.
No.
The pile over there. How many promotional items and gifts do you have?
You're putting in nothing.
So you have sardines and
blue
wasabi almonds.
No.
They
didn't get me my almonds this time.
They didn't get you.
Which just goes to show
this guy loves the wasabi.
Wasabi-coated almonds.
Yeah.
Yes, I do love them. And I eat a lot of sardines too. But nobody's gotten me anything free. Obviously, I'm starting to... slip. Sorry. So
okay.
What is this?
So I found it. So
what
I realized that I do a lot of public speaking. We go around the country and we have different clients. You know, you go to a lot of shows. So I was at a show and I found this piece of paper. I just moved my office and I cleaned up my office and I found this piece of paper and it's a speech that I gave back in 1980.
1980?
Public speaking.
Seeking his favorite hamburger, comma, not girl.
Now, I went to the Toronto City Finals. I came third in the city of Toronto. McDonald's found out about this speech back in 1980 and sent $100.
Look at you.
I know.
You look like Pete Townsend in 1963. You do. You got the
I
same
I was a
haircut,
fat, chubby Kevin Rosh in grade 4.
And did you draw this?
I drew this, yeah.
So
It's a bit demented. I don't know what my parents.
A bit.
The parenting skills that my Linda and Joe were instilling on
me. It's a hamburger sitting on.
It's a woman hamburger.
Something, and it has a girl's legs and a girl's shoulders and arms. And she's got a little crown on. And then over on the side is Ronald McDonald, like, up in the cloud.
I didn't draw that. I cut that out from something. But
and you wrote on it, "My Queen." All right, and so
I straw polled the school on what was their favorite burger.
Yeah.
I picked a McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, Canadian chain called Harvey's. Went through the school, and we decided that McDonald's was, and talked about the attributes.
You have to read this speech.
Okay. I'll start it.
So Kevin Rush is going to read his, what was it, third place speech you said?
Or
was
third place, it third in, place the city of Toronto.
In the city of Toronto speech about hamburgers.
A hamburger is a hamburger is a hamburger. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable judges, fellow students, and boys and girls, I had great difficulty picking a topic for this year's public speaking contest. But finally, after a number of hours, sitting around thinking about a topic, I picked one near and dearest to most of us, the hamburger. Is it true all hamburgers are the same? Not a chance. They're as different as a bunch of girls in a beauty contest. They all may look the same, but only one can win. I don't know who was bringing me up.
I actually think that's pretty good. That's not everybody could come up with
that. I said to myself, I'm going to have a Miss Hamburger pageant. If others can have a beauty pageant, I, Kevin Brosh, can have a Miss Hamburger pageant. So I decided to try and find out my favorite hamburger, not girl, which is the byline. Then we went around and we straw-polled the school. And so I end up going on to anoint McDonald's. The voting in my school was, if we could do this on Iron Chef, Burger King got 2 votes, Harvey's got 4 votes, Wendy's got 15 votes, and McDonald's got 29 votes. The students at Crescent Town School picked their winner, McDonald's. I had a fairly easy time picking my winner, Miss McDonald's, and here is what a picture of Miss McDonald's looks like. And I do believe that the teacher I had in the previous year, grade 3, was Miss McDonald. So I got called to the principal's office over the speaker.
Kevin Brosh, please come to principal. What was his name?
Don Moore. Don Moore.
Come to Principal Don Moore's office.
And there was, the principal didn't know what to do about it, because on his desk, in an envelope, was like drug money, McDonald's gift certificates in 25-cent increments, $100 worth. Like, I can make it rain at that point.
Absolutely make it rain.
So I took my parents, and my parents were divorced at the time, so I took my sister Denise, Linda, my mother, Joe, my father, to McDonald's, along with myself, and we went full hog. I remember it being like $6.75 for the family to eat.
And you couldn't eat another mouthful.
And I still had all this rain money.
This sweet
all
change.
Of these 25
cents.
So
this money didn't come to like the school. It came to you.
It came to the school
before
as
you.
A prize. Yeah, and then the principal was sitting there going like,
did he take a cut?
Was this, I don't know. I waited.
Principal Dahmer, if you're listening.
I waited in know. My hand, you know, like drug lords do. And I figured it felt pretty
this
close.
This is a little short. Principal Dahmer, I don't know what you're trying to pull here, man.
You don't want to be found with the wine bottles on your ankles and a stylus in your pocket.
I'm saying. So that's when your career in front of the camera began.
I've been getting paid to speak about food for a long time, sir.
By corporate monsters.
Yes. But
does that mean the Food Network pays you in coupons?
I get what I can get. I was hoping that I always tell you, this year maybe could you, you know, do a brother some good, and you always forget. You're a busy guy.
What kind of good do you want?
I get printer paper, staplers.
You got a stapler this year? I didn't get a stapler.
I re-gift them. Well, I steal them.
Oh.
But I steal them in their boxes, and I give them away at Christmas. And
that's why there are no office supplies in here this year.
Because I've taken them.
Because
I'm getting a bit now. I'm burned. What do you call it?
Burned out.
No.
You're jaded.
Jaded, yes. That word.
Well, I'll go into the kitchen. And you notice how the big pile of ingredients they have left over from Iron Chef battles.
Yes.
You see that grows during the season. I will completely scoop that stuff. I usually send back like a whole box of stuff. And I noticed, I went in there the other day, and there was like a lot of like some pretty high-end liquor out.
Did you get it?
I was like, no. I was like, I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back here, and there are a couple of things here that are worth having. And I can't. It was all
okay. Gone. I promise, because I'm going back to Canada. I didn't take it.
No, because they never let you back in.
I can't ship that.
You'd have to drink it here.
Yeah, which we could do if there was still some around.
No, there's not. I got nothing. I've got a bottle of Death Store Gin over there, and I paid retail for it.
Well, that's what you got to do sometimes.
You used to get a lot.
What's your favorite spirit right now of the moment?
You know what? Seriously, for the first time in my life, I'm a little behind getting into scotch, really getting into scotch whiskey. Being that I'm from the South, I've had a lot of bourbon.
Yeah.
And kind of was a bourbon fanatic. But I got to tell you, the complexity available, especially in Islay scotches, which is kind of what I'm liking.
Yeah.
So Lafroig and...
You're not a smoker. Are you an occasional pack smoker?
Because a lot of the Islay scotches... I used to smoke cigars, but I gave it up about 8 years ago.
Yeah. Those are the ones that have the peat... Yeah. Aspect to it. They're very sort of medicinal, you know.
I kind of like that. You know, Compass Box,
yeah.
They're peat monster whiskey. I like peat monster.
And because it's cooked over open fires,
right.
with peat, which it comes from the ground. It's dried in pieces that are similar to your fruitcake.
Maybe very hard and kind of dense.
I made a joke about your fruitcake the other day, and the look you flashed me was great TV.
It was good television.
I thought of a million and one uses for the
fruitcake.
Alton's fruitcake.
Besides doorstop.
There was window breaker.
Yeah.
Exercise equipment.
Yeah. You're going to build a whole series of weights based on
Christmas tree holder upper. Movie prop for stand-in for Gold in the movie prop industry.
Instead of Goldfinger, it'd be Fruitcake Finger. I get it.
And then there was one other one, a paperweight,
and just a paperweight. I thought that one lacked
the
creativity. But so Scotch. I mean, as you know, because you've traveled over there a fair bit, and you know how complex that is, and what goes into it, and what kind of still gets used, whether it's a pot still or columns.
The conformity of, say, bourbon. I mean, bourbon has a range in and of its category. There's a range of bourbons, but they're all sort of made to minimum standards of 60% corn, and so they often reflect in a similar way, or their definition is tighter than what Scotch can be, and a lot of that has to do with the geographical or the regionality of Scotland. The Highlands are different than the Lowlands, that are different right. than the Spey, that are different than the Orkney, the ones from Orkney or Islay,
right.
you know, the Hebrides. Islands, which, and those ones just get really complex, really, there's another word besides medicinal I'm looking for, the flavor of peat, they have the, it's like
medicinal.
Chloroform.
Medicinal, it's so perfect for it.
Well, I guess it is, but you know,
there's
a lot
another
of,
one, well, if you think of another one.
Okay, I'll think of it.
Are you a Scotch fan then?
Yeah, but I don't love the peaty ones.
No.
I like some of the smoky ones. So I'm probably more Spey into the Highlands.
Into the Highlands.
You know, I like the Glens.
Okay.
Right? The Glen is river.
Right.
Or stream.
Glenfiddich, Glenlivet.
Yeah, so those are the ones I probably go to more. And I have a long-standing relationship with Macallan. And they make a pretty mean... You know,
oh my gosh.
There are certain things that you see in the world of spirits, and when you travel the world and you'll be working for one monster company, there's only like four monster companies left, right? But Woodford Reserve,
yes,
is one thing that any company can drink, and if you have to sign it, like if you can't see your company's bottle or bottles behind a bar, it's like a Woodford is a pass. It's like, I guess, like a mulligan in golf. Everybody's allowed to have that and still sign it. And Macallan is another one. Even if you don't work for Macallan or the parent company, if you can't say your scotch at a bar, you'd be allowed to have the Macallan. And you always have to put the in, you know, it's the Macallan. You're always allowed to have a the Macallan and kind of write it off. I mean.
Because it's standard.
Yes. Yeah, there's something
about it. You kind of have to have it.
Yeah.
At least one.
I mean, sometimes your palate does get tired. You know, I've been drinking no red wine. I've just kind of come to it.
Except for the Cote d'Aron that we're having right
now. This is like the third bottle I've had in a week that's red, and I'm really enjoying that flavor again. Sometimes you got to get away for something for a while until you realize how much you appreciate it again. The Australians made a strategy out of selling wine that was, they would call it sugar jacked, right?
I mean, now, what does that actually mean?
They're
Sugarjacking
is the inclusion of sugar into the fermentation of the wine. So it's not, you're not just getting natural sugars from the fermentation, from the fruit. I know, and I'm not going to name names here, but I know that California had a bad year a couple of years ago, and I was down there doing some work with a number of wineries, and you could not go in to a grocery store
and find any sugar.
And you could find no sugar, and it was being bought third party through people just so you couldn't trace back to who's doing the. But everybody knew where it was going because I guess it had been a bad year. The Brix levels wasn't high enough to really produce outstanding wine, so they sort of cheated a bit. Now the Australians took it one step further and said, "There's nothing. Our fruit's good, our Brix are good, but we just want to make really heavy duty wine." There is a segment of the market that wants 15 to 17% alcohol,
and you can't. Can you even get 15 to 17% without adding sugar? Can you get that level of alcohol?
Well, no, because then you're looking at fortified, right, which is another thing. That's the inclusion of grain neutral spirits to stabilize the wine, and that was done historically.
That's more expensive, isn't it?
That's more expensive. Yeah, we're dumping sugar into the mix and letting it ferment, and using a really aggressive yeast strain,
right,
to chew through that sugar. It will give
and create
you
alcohol.
Yeah. But then you're not in character with the grape varietal, right? Like,
right.
Because certain grapes can only hit so many Brix. So it becomes an imperfect science. You're playing a bit of Dr. Frankenstein, I think. Frankenwine.
Frankenwine. You know, you could sell that.
So
how many
Kevin Braun's Frankenwine
could work. Simon Majumdar was telling me the other day about
how much do you love that guy?
I like Simon a lot. But he was telling me that he's been to 71 countries now. How many have you been to? Because the reason I say this is I don't remember how many years ago this was, and it was on Iron Chef, and it was one of like when you'd first come in, you know, for the beginning of a run, because we used to do, you know, 24 to 26 episodes, and you had your shoulder bag, and your shoulder bag had
Every airline,
but it wasn't what I noted, Kevin Brosh, was it wasn't just that you had every airline frequent flyer program thing. You were like diamond level. you were like platinum, diamond, super uranium level. So how many countries? Do you know?
83.
83 countries.
Yeah, 83.
I didn't know there were 83 countries.
There's 200.
I'm kidding. There are a lot more than that. And how many of those countries did you visit? Specifically after a spirit or a spirit-related story.
We did 60 episodes of Thirsty Traveler. We doubled up in Germany, in France, in Italy, in Canada, in the United States. So I have it, of the 59 episodes of Thirsty Traveler that we did, we visited 43 to 45 countries for the specific purpose of going for their wine, beer, or spirit.
Well, that still leaves another 40 countries. Were you just getting around?
Well, I did a show for Discovery Channel for a while.
Right.
Called Mega World, which you can still find. And it runs on HD Theater, I think, here. And it was a light science show for single men that had disposable income. So I was racing hand production motor vehicles, motorcycles. I went to CERN.
Did you?
I got to go to CERN. I didn't know what CERN was.
You know now, though, don't you?
I got to go to CERN and stand right next to the big machine. And it was going like, you're not testing it right now, are you? Because if it goes and it goes wrong, I don't want to
be here.
It was amazing. 5,000 people working underground.
Underground, completely.
3,000 Americans living permanently in either Switzerland or France.
Yeah, well, it crosses the border.
Underground. Like the cartoons.
Yes.
Like when the Tasmanian devil wanted to travel.
How many miles?
21-kilometer loop. I went to France, to Toulouse, to see the A380 being built. So number
That's impressive.
2, and 3. And the wiring that goes into these pieces of machinery that we trust our lives into. Another really great trick, because I've traveled so much, is I know how to kind of sort of fall asleep and keep your hand rocking. Somebody's noted that on me, right? If you keep your hand rocking, you can fly through almost any turbulence and not spill your wine on a plane. Because you're counteracting the activity of the plane.
Some centrifugal force also keeping the wine in the glass. So you can just sit there?
I kind of have this way of being able to fall asleep during Talladega Nights, the story of Ricky Bobby drinking good wine and first class, and just the hand keeps going like this. I think I'm going to have some sort of affectation.
it's going to be in the elbow or the
shoulder. I used to laugh at this one woman who lived on my street, and she always sat in a rocking chair. And even when you talk to her, when she's standing up on the sidewalk going, "How are you doing?" I'm doing it on purpose here for the microphone.
Yes, you
she
are.
She stands and rocks as if she's in the rocking chair. And I kind of want to stop her. And it was the only thing I didn't like about this motion that I have with my hand going back and forth. And you can do it in Jamaica when you're drinking your morning coffee and you're riding around on that parachute seat. What's it called? The pilot seat. That drops down, you know. And you just keep it going and you keep it going against the jump seat.
Yeah, jump seat.
You keep it going against the way the motion of the car is going and you'll never spill your drink.
Spill it. Best airline.
Okay, so I'm Star Alliance. So I fall into Lufthansa and Air Canada, and they're really, for me, they're the best alliance of airlines. Emirates is amazing. Cathay Pacific.
I've heard. Never been on.
So you're not seat 3C. You're Mr. Brosh. I flew with them from Los Angeles to Hong Kong, and then was flying from Hong Kong to Kuala Lumpur, which is really like a puddle jumper over there by their standards. And I got on the plane and I got into my first class seat, which is like a couch. And now on some of the planes, they have a couch for you and your spouse to sit on. They have couch seats.
Stop it.
Honest to God. Cathay Pacific. So this woman, the stewardess goes, "Good to see you again, Mr. Brosh." She goes, "You were with us flying from Vancouver the other day, weren't you?" And I chickened out and I just said, "Yes, I was. I can't believe you remember that." And I went to my seat, and she came over a couple of minutes later, and she went, "You lied to me, Mr. Brosh." She goes, "You were on LA to Hong Kong." And I couldn't believe it. And just the pronouns, they don't look at a piece of paper. They just, part of their training, you know, unlike, and there's a certain Air Canada crew, when I was flying back from New Delhi, where I just sit behind that curtain that they close and listen to them about the scheduling because they wanted to take a vacation. Yeah. Da, 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 da. And then this woman thought about it and how she figured it out on the plane. And she came up to me and she was very proper about it, but she was being a bit coy. And
she's messing with you.
That kind of service I love. So, I mean, Cathay, Emirates, Lufthansa.
Lufthansa is the best I've ever ridden.
Just so guten Tag.
Well, I remember coming back from which I'm not even sure what it means.
Bavarian. It's the Bavarian way of saying sort of next time or goodbye, hello.
Yeah?
Schuss, yeah. But so it's used in the south of Germany, in Bavaria, more as...
It's au revoir, except in Germany.
Yeah, exactly. Sehr gut.
I mean, when you go into a plane and you go into the bathroom and there are four windows... I'm in a better class than I'm usually
in. I want to say that's on the Airbus... A320-500
It's the 320-500. Absolutely correct.
Can I don't work for this
that
website.
Shows off, man.
Oh, I know. And you have windows while you're doing your thing.
Yeah, I like looking out a window.
And a flower. It's amazing.
And the flower thing?
The flower?
The petals?
Exactly. There was one Lufthansa, and it was in that – it was a different class, but it was in the A320 category. All the bathrooms were downstairs in the center of the plane in ring formation. So they were down on the storage level.
Okay,
so they got more – I've only seen it. I've flown on this one plane twice. But it was only with Lufthansa, and it was only Frankfurt to Toronto. And you go downstairs. You can't wait on the stairs. So the stairs become a bit of a negotiating problem when everybody wants to get up and go to the bathroom after the meal.
Right.
But there are seven bathrooms downstairs, and it looks like a nightclub because the stairs are underlit. They're using high-efficiency LED green and blue, grau und rot. And it's like, you know, and the green is go, and the red is stop, and it's – there's a water fountain down there.
So you go downstairs to go to the bathroom?
Yep.
Never seen this.
I've only seen that on that one plane. But there's a great website, and maybe they could sponsor your show. I receive no money from them right now. Novelty check to insert here.
I would take it.
SeatGuru.com.
SeatGuru.com.
Yeah.
Is this how you book your travel?
Well, now, yeah. I mean, because I've now cracked 1,000 flights. My first flight when I'm 18 years old.
right. 1,000.
Now, I have a 13-year-old.
Who tracks that for you? How do you know that?
I started going back as we were putting together our book and as we were putting together season 6 and we were going to Asia. And these were some of the questions that they wanted to ask you. Like you said, the countries. It becomes about the countries. It becomes the number of miles you've racked. It becomes about the number of flights you've taken. And so I went back and I would say within 5%, I knew that my first flight, when I thought I was going to die, flying to the Dominican Republic on a 1960s charter airline based out of Canada, where it still looked like Laugh-In.
Oh, my God.
And I didn't know wings had flex.
Yeah.
I thought wings just stood there like a wing.
So when that wing started doing this,
I was going, oh, my God, it's so old. It's like Goldie Hawn old. And I was like, I love Goldie Hawn on Laugh-In, but that's the final thought in my head. And the grandmother next to me goes like, just calm down, honey. This ain't my first barbecue, something like this. And I was trying to touch my girlfriend who was sitting two rows in front of me. We couldn't sit together. I knew nothing about how to fly. Now, doing Thirsty Traveler and working for the Food Network and doing all these other shows, and this is the way we now live our life to some degree. You know this. You fly, although you doth protest that you don't fly so much.
Right. But, I just snorted. Sorry.
But we've flown through the War on Terror, through SARS, through avian bird flu,
yep.
through liquid and gel bands,
yep.
through the shoe bomber,
yep.
through the mad farter.
I
just made him up. But, yeah.
But there was also the underwear bomb.
The underwear bomb
which
guy.
Which I thought was the farter.
Yeah.
Could have been.
Like, I guess it could have been. Yeah.
But we have.
So doing that and knowing that and living your life and having relationships severed because of the way we choose to earn our
keep.
It made me want to investigate making sure I was on the best plane or had the best opportunity to use the coupons or to trade in miles to get upgraded.
Right.
If you can ever fly to Asia or, you know, across the equator, the international timeline, and do it not in economy. Right. They call it executive class. They call it business. They call it business first. They have first business. If you can ever do it in that fashion, you know, it becomes that thing. Would you rather have one $10 bottle of wine or one $100 bottle of wine? I often go, I'd rather have the 10 $10 bottles of wine.
Sometimes. Depends on where you are.
But with flying, I think we owe it to ourselves once in our life to fly in a business class or in a first class fashion where they give you pajamas on Qantas.
Yeah.
They will steam press your jacket and your shirt. There's some guy with an iron downstairs underneath you as you sleep.
Listen, Lufthansa, I flew once on a Lufthansa 747 first class.
Were you upstairs?
Upstairs.
Isn't that wicked?
But there was somebody cooking up there. They cooked food.
For you, in front of you.
They had a caviar cart with big frozen blocks with the vodka bottles and the – I mean, it was
– I flew to Qantas.
Okay.
With the WWE guys.
Did you?
We from L.A. Okay. to Sydney, and we got to the lounge, and there were four crew guys, the haggard crew guys that had the jackets from the last 20 years, and they're going, yeah, there's four that took our seats, so we're flying back of the bus, boys. And we're sitting there going like this. We're the four from Thirsty Traveler that took their seats. My buddy, the audio guy from Thirsty Traveler, Mike, who recorded every
That's
bit
funny,
of sound.
By the way, because I had an audio guy named Mike.
Was yours a Newfie, too? Because mine was a Newfie,
no,
a Canadian.
Mine wasn't a Newfie, but it was Mike, anyway.
He got to sit next to Triple H on the flight over.
Are you kidding?
And I had Roddy Piper in front of me, and the Undertaker was across the row and over.
Are you serious?
And I don't know these guys. I don't really watch it. I mean,
you were aware.
Triple H had his breakfast in the morning, and they're big breakfasts in first class on Qantas when you've been in the air for 16 and a half hours.
Yeah, I bet that's a full on.
Yeah.
What do they serve?
We started with porridge and rolls and coffee and toast and juice and a smoothie. And then a smoothie in there. And you can have all of it or none of it, you know, or just particular aspects. Fresh fruit bowl. Then they do an omelet.
Of course.
Or you can have steak and eggs.
Yes. Thank you.
And then there was croissants and some pastries and that. And Triple H, as told by my audio guy, Mike, he goes, I'll have another one, please. And these guys are not like in their wrestling gear. They look very different. But they to attest, like when you're standing there holding up them when they want to go to the bathroom, they're all wearing ear pods. They're all like they're all listening to their own music, their own mantra stuff. They have real stitches in their foreheads, and they have real black eyes. And you know, it's pretty amazing. And this guy just wanted another one.
So that, was that the best?
So, I mean, that was one of the most interesting ones. And they had to get off the plane and do a 3.5 hour layover in Sydney to fly to Melbourne, to fly to Adelaide, and wrestle that night.
Oh my God.
And I was looking at these guys, and they were all well dressed. Nobody was talking to each other. And I'm going, at what point do they take that little pill that makes their eyes roll back
and go
into
crazy.
Their head and go crazy? Because surely they got to be doing that. Because I couldn't make it to my hotel. Like, sometimes you can't get to your hotel, and you're being pampered, and you're being driven, and you don't even have to tip or lift your luggage. I'm going, these guys got to go out and now wrestle
each other
for an hour, and then do it again the next night, then do it again the next night, then do it again the next night, and then fly back to America. Unbelievable.
I don't understand how you do that.
Do they get paid more than us?
Yes.
And they have their own doll. See, if somebody just made a doll of me,
yeah. Because you're pretty much Omni sports guy.
I take a global approach to sports. I love cycling the Tour de France. I love tennis. I love.
Do you think cycling will ever come back? It has been a tough bunch of years.
If America, how do you get America onto something? You give them the World Cup. Like, you give them a tournament and let them own it and kill it, right? Yeah. When we were here doing Iron Chef,
yes,
wherever we are, whatever, somewhere in America, I spent Sunday afternoons in sports bars in Manhattan with guys going, I can't believe I'm watching chicks play soccer and I like it. Yeah, because the American soccer team, the women's soccer team for the Women's World Cup, is just such a dynamic a group of sports-minded individuals.
It's better than watching any men's soccer.
They don't go down. They don't hold their legs and knees. They just play through it, right?
Tough girls.
I think if anything's going to save professional cycling, no, I was in Nashville working for Bombay Sapphire. What an odd place to work.
Did you get some free Bombay Sapphire?
I got some free Bombay Sapphire. And I couldn't believe how hot and sexy Nashville is.
Nashville's awesome.
They call it like Hollywood East.
East.
Because the amount of people that go to Nashville that are attractive and talented that get picked up for music videos, albums, country music channels, country western movie, anything that has a slightly southern bent. And it's such a it's a very rich – they have a hockey team.
Go figure.
I felt underdressed. Yeah. I phoned it in. I was like, I'm going to Nashville in the summer.
No,
it's just going to be T-shirts and jeans. And I was obviously very underdressed. No, I mean, you don't have to wear a lariat or anything like that or a hat.
No,
I mean, because it's such a medical community, too, so there's a lot of money there. I had a really amazing
time.
Yeah,
good time.
In Nashville and watching men cycling in Colorado. See, that's the kind of mix I bring to the table.
I want to get back
my
to the
red
question.
Wine brings all the boys to the.
It does. I want to ask you the question I was getting to way back when we were talking about Best Airline, and I got off on a Best Airline. Having consumed spirits in as many places as you have, for both Americans and Canadians, what are, say, five things we ought to be drinking that we're not? Because I consider you an expert in this area.
I'll joke and say the bottle of Johnny Walker Blue Label that we were given on Iron Chef America with our names.
You got one of those. We both got it. Yeah.
Oh, you didn't know I got one. You didn't think I was.
No, we all did. I got one. You got one. I got one.
And half the kitchen staff got them.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought it was special.
Now, in Canada, I can take that bottle back and get 40 cents.
Stop it.
Yes. You want me to take yours back?
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
I'll FedEx you my Johnny Walker. I've only drunk about two fingers out of it.
I'm just past half. And this is the point where, okay, so what we should be drinking,
what are the things that we're drinking that we're not? Okay, because Americans, we drink a lot of vodka.
Yeah.
We drink a bit of bourbon. We're getting better about our bourbon, right?
I mean, the variety and the degree, the quality of bourbon is stepping up.
Bourbon and rye.
Yes.
That we're getting to. But Americans in general, I think, we're just getting into gin.
Yeah, gin's always going to be a tough nut.
Why do you think that?
I think there's something about the palate issue where I see like juniper being universally accepted because it grows in more like-minded places. The botanicals that they use in gin will always make it more acceptable in Europe.
Because Europe is more used to botanicals and liqueurs.
Yes.
And
in medicinal products, like Amaro, like in aperitifs and digestives.
They also we don't have digestives.
They also have 400 or 500 years on us.
Yeah.
Right? And I often speak to layman's terms, but it must have been so friggin' bad drinking bathtub gin and bathtub absinthe that people got on a boat to nowhere and lived 3 months on a boat saying, it's got to be better over there, wherever it is we're going.
Wherever it is we're going.
We'll take our chances because it
Good
was
point.
So bad there.
Good point.
Right? I mean, you'd cut your ear off at 5 shillings on a liter of anything if you drank enough of it.
Yeah.
I think gin's always going to be a challenge, and I do see it. We're a pretty wide country, both Canada and America. And so I don't think the temperance zones change, right?
Yeah.
So I think it will be agreeable on the East Coast more and earlier than it will be on the West Coast or more in the the north to the south. I do believe in those sweeping generalizations. You'll be able to prove me wrong. I mean
– No, it won't. Things down south move much, much, much slower because anything that pushes you off of tradition is troublesome.
But that's so great that they hold on to tradition because sometimes we look to places like the south to bring back tradition and to hold on to it for us when we want to go out and explore.
Which is why you can find more moonshine down there than you can gin.
Bitters and digestives.
So you're talking about more complex flavors.
Yeah, like an Aperol, Amaro, Campari. All of these, the French are trying really hard internationally on Saint-Cosette, right?
Really?
5 to 7. And it's the reintroduction of the sophisticated happy hour. From 5 to 7. We know it a lot in England where people after work go to the pub.
Yes.
And they'll have a pint or two with their friends and then jump on the train and then go home.
Right.
And you can do it I guess if you worked in New York City, you could allow yourself a quick drink one or two nights a week and jump on the train and be
in Philadelphia.
Well, of
course, because you're going to take the subway or the train where I am.
Even if you're taking a regional train, like what's it like for you in Atlanta?
You can't do that. Well, you get in your car.
Yeah.
So we drink at home. Or we're drinking in a place we're going to stay.
Yeah.
People don't realize that the cosmopolitan, and I don't mean the drink, but I mean the city experience is so much different when public transportation and cabs and trains are more the norm.
Yeah.
You drink. There's a drink stop between work and home.
Yes.
See, we can't do that because we're driving in rush hour.
And that can be a decompression from your day.
But I do think that from a social standpoint, the social drinking of being able to say, okay, we've worked all day. We're now, and I would even hypothesize here that, okay, let's say you and I have jobs at blah, blah, blah investment bank.
Okay.
And we both live in some suburb someplace.
KBAB Investment Corp.
Fine. Fantastic. At the end of the day, we hit a pub, we have a few, and then we go off to our respective homes. I would suggest that makes the work environment better.
I would agree with that 100%.
But of course, in England, we're talking about pints.
Yeah.
What you're talking about in France with this whole 5 to 7 thing is far more complex, I imagine.
Yeah. We're looking at champagne cocktails. We're looking at French 75s, Lillette Blanc, Lillette Rouge. We're talking about things that actually also get the gastric juices going and set yourself up for a proper meal that will be digested well.
Okay. I don't think that Americans understand. Oh, gosh, I want to be really careful how to say this. The European mindset of the digestive.
Yeah.
This idea that you can actually drink something that prepares you for a meal. This is alien to the American mind.
I think I agree with that big statement.
Do you believe that it's true? Are there things you can drink that actually make your gastric system more receptive to eating?
Do you not?
I don't know. I don't have enough.
You love Campari and soda.
I do. Here's the thing,
that
though.
Bitter, astringent.
I love
astringent,
bitter. It's funny. I like stuff that tastes like medicine. I admit it to you. I like absinthe. I like Saint-Germain.
And you like Isla whiskeys.
I do. Oh, my gosh, I like Isla whiskeys. But I can never tell if it's the compounds or just the alcohol.
If I was to slap you in the face really hard before dinner...
See where this goes.
Would it not awaken some of the senses and heighten you? I mean, I'm not, maybe not way.
So you're saying that it's a wake up call.
Ow! I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry. I said I'd only nip at your ankles.
Ow! I think I'm bleeding. So that's what it is?
I think what it does is because it's if you haven't had anything except for coffee, say, since lunch, right? And you're pouring this really heavily, like 56 herbs and spices and barks, and you're pouring all this stuff in with Angus Gurr bitters in Trinidad, where it's made, in Trinidad and Tobago. Right. They rub it into their scalp when they're feeling sick. They put 5-6 drops every morning in a glass of water and drink it down. It's belief that it is true medicine, right? If you take the practices of having a bit of Guinness when you're pregnant, or just to bring the milk in.
To bring the milk in.
Right? The lactic acid, is that what it...
That's what they say.
That's what they say. If we believe in those tall tales or truths, it makes sense for this stuff. Right? Peppermint settles the stomach. We drink peppermint tea.
Absolutely.
Now, if peppermint and menthol and mint and fennel and all of those ingredients are in a bit of alcohol, and we drink a little bit of it, not the whole bottle.
A little.
Before and or after.
It makes complete sense. I mean, I've never heard anybody say this with the slap you in the face thing, but you're right. It's kind of like a reset for senses that have not had anything during the day.
Yeah.
But coffee... And in very few flavor profiles. So you're saying a little bit of something that's complex, bitter, astringent, is basically getting that slap.
If I slap you in the face, you're going to be a bit bitter and astringent at me.
but you're making sense, though. And I've never heard anybody put it that way, that there is a priming the pump, the sensory pump for a meal. So you've said now that bitters and liqueurs,
yes,
are one of the things,
yep,
we should be drinking. All right, what's another one? I mean, you've been around. Take it.
Alcoholic
time.
Milkshakes. No. I think with the – okay, we're looking at global invasion and where the markets are turning right now. We're looking at India. We're looking at Asia. We're looking at Brazil.
Right.
Right. I do believe that cachaça, Brazilian rum, country rum.
Tell everybody what the difference is between – the two, though, because there are subtle differences between rum and cachaça.
Well, rum is made from sugar cane is cut, it's burned, it's made into molasses, and then from the molasses, rum is made.
Yes, sir.
This is made from the cane juice,
right.
So they don't concentrate it and darken it up what's the words? If I'm using the wrong words, but they're making it from the juice of the squeezed fresh cane,
as opposed to the cooked. Here's the thing: rum is a byproduct of making sugar.
Correct.
You make sugar, you have molasses left over, you ferment the molasses, you make rum. Cachaça is different because you're not doing it as a byproduct of sugar. You're actually using the sugar squeezings,
yeah,
and instead of making, so it's a more of, well.
It's not actually more
refined is the wrong way of putting it, but there's...
It's simplified.
It's,
yeah,
simplified, and you don't have all those burned flavors and
yeah,
the darker flavors.
Like your fruitcake.
Yeah, like my fruitcake, which is not made with cachaça.
I'm sorry.
Do you like cachaça?
I do. I turned off mojitos. I don't know why, because, you know, I've been to Cuba, and I went to Hemingway's.
Who doesn't want a mojito?
I think I was just getting a lot of poor mojitos. I was getting them that were either with the balance wasn't correct. There was too much mint. There was not enough sugar. There was too much white rum. You know, and I just wasn't seeing a well-prepared drink. You know, when it's 90 degrees, when it's 100 degrees out, sometimes you just want something to cool you down. But I was finding that I was seeing a mojito craze go on where I wasn't seeing a lot of respect, a lot of reverence given to this drink, which was so good. It stopped Ernest Hemingway in his tracks, right? So if you can do that to such a famous and poetic style of writer,
then
you know that the drink's got to be better than the one I'm getting right now in my hand, which really...
But then he was always a rum guy because he drank a lot of daiquiris as well.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite drinks.
Yeah.
People always take frozen daiquiris.
But again, we've co-opted...
Yeah.
Daiquiris,
yeah,
and made them into these sugary, sweet, icy, out of a slushy machine.
Well, we've screwed over rum entirely in this country, which is pretty odd when,
yeah,
you think about the fact that we came out of that whole molasses rum slaves triangle,
yeah,
trade.
Well, which, but, there's a dirty side to that, and it's a very dirty art, like molasses and rum factories. They're really dirty places. There's not a lot of joy there working in them.
Is cachaça not like that when you go to some place where they distill cachaça?
I've been to two cachaça distilleries. They were much cleaner. There was a lot more care and detail. it seemed like there were better sanitary conditions. Mm. It's going to be the third largest economy in the world within 5 years. I got to learn Portuguese, Brazilian Portuguese. I've got to learn Mandarin.
Mandarin and whatever.
Screw Francophone Canadian French.
No.
That will just make me,
We have to speak Mandarin. We got to speak Portuguese and Hindi, they're not speaking Hindi, I guess.
I guess Hindi would be the best one. I'm going to go Asian on the next one and say I think we really have to wrap our heads around sake and other Asian distillates.
How the heck? Okay. Let me say this to you. I adore sake. I can't sort it all out, man. There are so many styles. There are so many small variances. And I understand that that happens in any spirit. Scotch is a good example.
My Achilles heels are Italian wine and French wine. And just, you know, the appellations, the coats.
Oh, my
gosh.
Blah, blah, blah. How do you sort out sake?
I think in larger cosmopolitan cities where there's a significant Asian base, you would be able to find introduction to sake course. And I think there's a lot of good that can come from just understanding the general tomes, the general definitions of the five or six broad range types of sake. One's floral.
Yes.
Right? There's floral aromatic. One's almost savory. Some are sweeter. They need to be served cold and chilled in the true Asian style. We were used to bad product. I guess it's like the equivalent to, say, cooking wine. We know now that horrible wine that they used to put into food was bad for food. We can't drink it, but sure, let's put it into our beef bourguignon.
It's bad for everything.
It's bad for everything, yeah, right? You want to cook with good wine. Not bad wine. So with sake, they would take, you know, the 70s and 80s sushi dining experience of sake where they brought it to your table.
And it was warm.
In a carafe that was warm. It was a horrible representation of what it is when you finally make it to Japan, or if you're drinking soju from Korea.
Soju is a whole other school.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole other.
And a lot of these things are made with, you know, we're looking at the change in the grain base for our fermentables, right?
Right.
Budweiser now is making their beer more with rice than corn.
Absolutely.
Because corn is evil. Is corn evil?
Corn is not technically evil, but rice is, listen, in parts of America, a lot easier to grow. And much higher yield.
Now, but it wasn't. When was rice really started to be first grown in America? I didn't think we had the temperate region for it.
No, you got to look back to colonial times when Carolina rice was a really big deal, but it was incredibly hard to work. Now, you go down to southern Louisiana, you go to Arkansas, you go to parts of Texas, you notice that all the guys are wearing Budweiser hats.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. They're selling all of their rice to Budweiser.
To Budweiser, yeah. And that it's cheaper than corn, and it's less desirable than corn because corn's being used for alternative purposes now.
Absolutely, because it's more profitable to use corn to make ethanol.
And, I've been in Asia, and I've been in Louisiana, and I know that stinking, hot, humid... So, yeah, you're right. When you drink, what's it called? I think it's called, it's not called Old V. We have a beer called Old Vienna in Canada, but there's a, or it's called VO. And it's a Taiwanese beer. I'm sorry. And when you taste a rice beer, it really tastes different than what we're normally used to here in North America. It's not like you don't get used to it. But it has a different end note. Like it sits on your tongue longer.
Well, the malt,
aftertaste.
You're not getting the malt that you would ordinarily get.
And malted barley. And even unmalted. I mean, the difference between malted barley and unmalted is there's a palate. There's a flavor profile difference.
Completely. And also a mouthfeel. The gravity is different. So there's a weight difference on the tongue.
I think we're going to see those big changes. Sake can be a really harmonious thing. I don't think we're going to be drinking sake with steaks anytime soon. It's not to say that we can't do elements of protein, shabu-shabu I have this love affair with the style presentation in Asian countries where, you know, they pour the sake into a box, right? They overflow the box.
Overflow it.
Onto a little spill tray to show you that it's the hospitality. It's like, thank you for coming here. You know, it means the world to me that you're supporting my endeavors and my so I'm going to be hospitable to you and welcome you to my restaurant. It's not this. Wait to be seated, please, sir.
I'm getting a finger, an index finger.
Wait to be seated. Hang on a second. I'm gonna
check your reservation.
OMG, gotta go. Some guy's here dining alone again. I think he looks like the wingman from Iron Chef America. And then it's like, welcome to my restaurant. I was like,
The first time that I had a, people, I think a lot of folks, if you haven't been to Japan, don't realize that there are effervescent sakes. And the first time that I got hold of bubbling, unfiltered sake.
Does it feel almost like it's going off? Like it's,
yes.
It's, yeah.
There are all these weird sensations that come with it.
The acidic bite of it is... nothing like you've ever experienced,
nothing.
And it's proper.
Yeah. I didn't know then.
Did you ever smell apple or banana?
Banana for sure.
Yeah. It's crazy. And you don't
banana.
Expect that either.
No, because I didn't expect that level of fruit. But that set me off on trying to
discover. You say, who put my banana in my sake? Did he say that?
No, I didn't. But next time I'm going to.
I went. Who put banana
well, because you're the drinking robot.
Sake.
Robot sake got some banana. But the complexity of sake, I think, scares a couple of people because it's like you go to, whether it's a sushi restaurant or wherever, in a big city like, say, New York, and you see the sake menu.
Yeah.
It's really...
We're intimidated and we're afraid scary. Of looking dumb. In many situations, or ordering something where it looks like we have no idea.
I don't know what I'm doing.
But part of that, again, like if you take a course and you know the ground basics, and then you want to go to good places that will nurture and support that.
So you see it that understanding enhances the experience.
I think so. We're only scared of things we don't understand.
So have you found that the more that you learn about these things throughout your travels, the more you appreciate the products?
Definitely. Yeah. And my want to share my knowledge with people, I've seen people benefit from the way I speak about things on stage when I tell a story, being in a family home somewhere and drinking a Pinot de Charente, which is it's a sort of a young wine in the Cognac region.
I didn't know that.
Of France, and it's a very specific wine that's made with cognac grapes, and it's light enough.
It's before they make the cognac,
yeah,
right?
But Pinot is its own thing, and it has its own place, and it's with ham and melon at the table. But when I come back and tell the story, people want to get their hands on things. You know, when I get on stage, I either chastise or it's a bit of a sermon. It's a bit of like, you know, I can get very... evangelical.
Do you preach?
I sort of. Sometimes I get up there and I feel like I am just...
What have you been soapboxing about lately?
I'm like Carrot Top when I get on stage. So I bring 100 things and I'm gonna always touch the same 60. And then the other 40 are sort of decided upon on the day, my mood, the energy in the room.
In the room.
I really work that way. I've worked with great speakers that have come after me and I've opened for them or, you know, they've opened for me and I've closed. And these guys are like Seinfeld comedians, right? One of my funniest comedic bits is watching Aziz Ansari talk about Jay-Z and Kanye West. And I thought he did it so amazingly spontaneously.
And it was all exactly like the night before and the next.
I saw him on the chair next to Leno doing the exact same bit. And they hit it to within 5 or 10 seconds. And they know
so
their
it's all
beats.
A timing issue.
I want to talk about so much. And I'll look in the audience and I'll work with the audience to help shape the scope of like, we didn't know what we were going to talk about in here, which is what I love about you in this in particular. It was like, we'll just get in there and talk. You talked to Bobby Flay about horses?
Horses.
That was my horse imitation.
It's his thing. He likes
horses.
See,
did you expect me to do a horse imitation?
I didn't see it coming and it was good. It scared me. I actually looked around thinking there might
be. You thought I was going to vomit from the wine.
No, not yet. Where's the one place you haven't been you want to go?
Vietnam.
You haven't? How did you go to that many countries to not go to
Vietnam?
It's like
the donut hole. It's the donut hole for me.
How could that have happened?
I don't really know.
Because people that are into culinary stuff, it's like in their first encounter.
Yeah, it just never materialized before we were done our run. And, you know, I guess the infrastructure or the tourism department in Vietnam isn't so big.
Are there any spirits there that are considered?
Nothing that you can't see sort of half reflected in other sort of Asian or Southeast Asian spirits that are all made from sorghum bases.
Sorghum
is a huge base for fermentables in that part of the world, or rice or things of that nature.
Yeah.
So like soju, sochi, you know, they're all elements of the same, and even the names are sort of
real close.
Yeah. So I'd say Vietnam right now. I mean, it might change tomorrow. Can I phone in edit tomorrow if it changes?
Sure. But I think Vietnam would be a big one. I haven't been either.
Yeah.
I really want to go.
I've been to Iceland. I've been to Greenland. I've been up through I'm afraid to go to Norway because it's the only Scandinavian country I haven't found myself in. And there's like a supporters list of people that are going to come and get me if I don't get to Norway. Pretty soon. I have an invitation for next May, but it might be too late. It just might be like
Oh, so you come to Norway last. I see how it is. That kind of thing?
Yeah.
Worst country. Where you don't need to go back. Come on, Kevin. There's got to be one country where you're like, no, I won't.
There was an episode of Thirsty Traveler, and we did do it in the United States of America, one of the greatest countries on planet Earth. And this was the most boring, passionless story we've ever done. And I can't name them because I do so much work in this state right now. And it was the most lifeless, heartless show of a Thirsty Traveler episode. We had a French chef that didn't care about the product, and we had a family of abstainers, fifth generation makers of this product. Four generations abstained from drinking it because I guess the great, 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 great grandfather did such a good job of almost, you know, and it was lifeless. And we did this ubiquitous real estate balloon ride over the, oh, so bad.
So, in other words, America is
no,
the country.
No.
Yes.
No.
That's what you said.
No.
So, America is the country, the worst country.
No, come on.
Answer.
I got my I-94 until 2017.
Oh, all right. Not America.
And I have to get a cosigner for the next one, for the extension.
Who can cosign?
You could cosign.
Oh, I'm done. I'm in.
Why don't you just cosign for me right now?
Did you bring the forms?
I didn't bring the
along
forms.
With your speech from which
my
grade
speech.
Was it?
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls,
boys and girls,
honorable judges, fellow students. Let me really answer the question for you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to do it, dude. I thought Portugal was going to be really boring. I didn't grow up with any Portuguese friends. I didn't understand Portugal. I thought it was like Spain, right?
Beautiful, but with great booze.
I was so blown away. Yeah, I know where I'm. See, I have to work through my mind works like this.
Well, it takes time.
Chile.
Not going back.
Name a Chilean comedian.
You got me.
I got everyone.
So
there isn't one.
So countries that can't create comics.
Not so good.
Not so good. What do they drink there?
Oh, the pisco,
pisco.
Wine.
Pisco. Well, Chile and Peru both argue.
They
over
argue
pisco.
Over who is the creator of it.
So you don't need to go back to Chile.
I don't need to go back to Chile. I liked Chile. I liked it well enough. It's a long, it's a boring drive
because
it's just straight, right down to the Andalusians, where the penguins are.
Penguins. It's not.
Morgan Freeman has a place there.
Yeah.
Do you know it?
I saw that movie. That's very funny, actually. Let's call Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman.
I try to get him on the phone and say, take us to your place down in Tierra del Fuego.
Yeah, it's Tierra del Fuego.
I think it is Tierra del Fuego. Or is that not part of Argentina? I can't ever remember.
Well, they sort of run.
They right run there. Right
it's
down
the it's the Andes. It's the Andes that that separate the two.
Yeah, those are mountains, by the way.
Yeah. And what they do is they have this annual tomato fight where they just try and throw things over the Andes and get them
and
to land
the other
in the other country.
It's tomatoes?
Yeah.
I thought it'd be potatoes because they were potatoes.
Oh, potatoes. That's true.
You say potato, I say tomato.
That's right. Well, I'm Canadian, you're American. Do you have your tattoo? Show me your tattoo. I'll give you 50 cents.
Which one? I have a couple of them.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Things I didn't know about. Oh my God, we're getting nude here.
No, I reckon
I have three.
But really? What are your three?
But I have two of them are the same, but they're symmetrical.
Well, like, are we like
Thor.
A Four?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, my God. No, this is hilarious.
I want to see this. I want to see this. Where's
okay.
Four?
So that was, okay, my, okay, let's start with the first one. The Canadian Maple Leaf.
Oh, you got
over.
A Canadian
okay.
Maple Leaf.
I was
over
testing
your heart.
It out. It was that or a Fishbone logo.
That's
or Red Hot Chili Peppers.
That's a very small okay. Leaf, though. You should have that made bigger if you really care.
Okay.
Or what's,
so,
all right.
It's right
so
there.
One. Okay. One tattoo.
Right over my
your heart.
Over my heart.
Well, it's
okay.
Close to your heart. It's
and then I got
Maple adjacent.
I got Thor, who is a protector for me. And in Nordic
Thor.
Times and in Germanic times, people would adorn their houses in times of distress with an
with
image
Thor?
Of Thor, god of thunder and lightning.
Yeah.
He's a protector god.
I didn't
right?
know
that. So I was having some bad times.
So you got Thor.
I got Thor.
Does Thor match on that side?
Thor matches on that side.
All right.
So I went to this symmetrical artist who I
actually
just lucked into. And he reversed it and he flipped it. And he took 2 hours for a 5-minute line drawing of Thor going like this.
Really?
And he kept laying it down, and I was going. I was looking at my watch, going, "I gotta fly to Australia the next day, dude."
Yeah, could you go?
And he goes like this. He goes, "Look at me."
Yeah.
He goes, "Look at me," because he was symmetrical.
Oh.
All of his tattoos and all of his piercings were identical on each single side of him.
That was his specialty.
That was his specialty, and I lucked into him, and he took 2 hours.
That's
okay.
All right.
Okay.
So I've got a Apis mellifera honeybee.
There we go.
I've got
look
honeybee on one side.
I never knew this about you.
I've got this was from Feasting on Asphalt, the motorcycle show I did when we finished.
Which was wonderful. Was that when you put them down? Good thing.
No. This was in the one after that. So
okay.
I got this in Minneapolis.
It's a good thing you didn't scratch that off.
And it's got my, it doesn't scratch off a skull with a
that's quality
a fork. It's not about the quality of the ink. It's about where you work.
No, hang on a second. I just saw all the bros tattoos. I can't believe that just happened.
I cannot believe that just happened.
We almost took our shirts off here.
Well, the video aspect to a podcast isn't that much more expensive. I really do believe
you
should.
The mystery of not seeing is sometimes better.
I think it is. I think it is. Jesus, that's amazing.
All right, cheers, Kevin Brosh. Thanks a lot for being on the podcast.
Sure, my
thanks
boss.
For the wine and your speech.
And my speech and your stylus.
I've got a spoon that works as a stylus and a copy of a speech with a drawing of a hamburger with girl legs coming out of it.
Well, food fans, that's about enough for today. I want to thank all of you for listening. And I especially want to thank Kevin Brosh for spending so much time with me. It's I got to tell you, we did drink a little bit of wine and we did take our shirts off to compare tattoos. That wasn't just made up radio. And all I can say is I am so, so very glad there is not a video component to this show, nor will there ever be if it keeps going like this. Anyway, thanks for listening. And until next time, America, cook smart. Oh, and beyond America, because you might not even be in America. I forget. That's how this whole podcast thing works. Cool. World. Cook smart.